and his father's father had never lost their lands. He had. I rose too high, loved too hard, dared too much. I tried to grasp a star, overreached, and fell. After the Battle of the Bells, when Ares Targaryen had stripped him of his titles and sent him into exile in a mad fit of ingratitude and suspicion, the lands and lordship had remained within House Cunnington, passing to his cousin, Sir Ronald, the man whom John had made his castellan when he went to King's Landing to attend Prince Rhaegar. Robert Baratheon had completed the destruction of the Griffins after the war. Cousin Ronald was permitted to retain his castle and his head, but he lost his lordship, thereafter being merely the Knight of Griffin's Roost, and nine-tenths of his lands were taken from him and parcelled out to neighbour lords who had supported Robert's claim. Ronald Conington had died years before. The present Knight of Griffin's Roost, his son Ronnet, was said to be off at war in the Riverlands. That was for the best. In John Connington's experience, men would fight for things they felt were theirs, even things they'd gained by theft. He did not relish the notion of celebrating his return by killing one of his own kin. Red Ronnet's sire had been quick to take advantage of his lord cousin's downfall, true, but his son had been a child at the time. John Connington did not even hate the late Sir Ronald as much as he might have. The fault was his. He had lost it all, at Stony Sept, in his arrogance. Robert Baratheon had been hiding somewhere in the town, wounded and alone. John Connington had known that, and he had also known that Robert's head, upon a spear, would have put an end to the rebellion, then and there. He was young and full of pride. How not? King Ares had named him Hand and given him an army, and he meant to prove himself worthy of that trust, of Rhaegar's love. He would slay the rebel lord himself and carve a place out for himself in all the histories of the Seven Kingdoms. And so he swept down on Stony Sept, closed off the town, and began a search. His knights went house to house, smashed in every door, peered into every cellar. He had even sent men crawling through the sewers. Yet somehow Robert still eluded him. The townsfolk were hiding him. They moved him from one secret bolt-hole to the next, always one step ahead of the king's men. The whole town was a nest of traitors. At the end they had the usurper hidden in a brothel. What sort of king was that who would hide behind the skirts of women? Yet whilst the search dragged on, Eddard Stark and Huster Tully came down upon the town with a rebel army. Bells and battle followed, and Robert emerged from his brothel with a blade in hand, and almost threw John on the steps of the old sept that gave the town its name. For years afterwards, John Connington told himself that he was not to blame, that he had done all that any man could do. His soldiers searched every hole and hovel. He offered pardons and rewards. He took hostages and hung them in crow cages and swore that they would have neither food nor drink until Robert was delivered to him. All to no avail. Tywin Lannister himself could have done no more. He had insisted one night to Blackheart during his first year of exile.
"And there is where you're wrong," Mars Toyne had replied. "Lord Tywin would not have bothered with a search. He would have burned that town and every living creature in it. Men and boys, babes at the breast, noble knights and holy septons, pigs and whores, rats and rebels. He would have burned them all. When the fires guttered out and only ash and cinders remained, he would have sent his men in to find the bones of Robert Baratheon. Later, when Stark and Tully turned up with their host, he would have offered pardons to both of them, and they would have accepted and turned for home, with their tails between their legs."
He was not wrong, John Connington reflected, leaning on the battlements of his forebears. I wanted the glory of slaying Robert in single combat, and I did not want the name of butcher. So Robert escaped me, and cut down Rhaegar on the trident. I failed the father, he said, but I will not fail the son. By the time Connington had made his descent, his men had gathered the castle garrison and surviving small folk together in the yard. Though Sir Ronnet was indeed off north somewhere with Jaime Lannister, Griffin's Roost was not quite bereft of griffins. Amongst the prisoners were Ronnet's younger brother, Raymond, his sister, Lynn, and his natural son, a fierce red-haired boy they called Ronald Storm. All would make for useful hostages, if and when Red Ronnet should return to try and take back the castle that his father had stolen. Connington ordered them confined to the West Tower, on the guard. The girl began to cry at that, and the bastard boy tried to bite the spearman closest to him. "Stop it, the both of you," he snapped at them. "No harm will come to any of you, unless Red Ronnet proves an utter fool." Only a few of the captives had been in service here when John Connington had last been lord. A grizzled sergeant, blind in one eye, a couple of the washerwomen, a groom who had been a stable boy during Robert's rebellion, the cook who had grown enormously fat, the castle armourer. Griff had let his beard grow out during the voyage, for the first time in many years, and to his surprise it had come in mostly red, though here and there ash showed amidst the fire. Clad in a long red and white tunic embroidered with the twin griffins of his house, counterchanged and combatant, he looked an older, sterner version of the young lord who had been Prince Rhaegar's friend and companion. But the men and women of Griffin's Roost still looked at him with stranger's eyes. "Some of you will know me," he told them. "The rest will learn. I am your rightful lord, returned from exile. My enemies have told you I am dead. Those tales are false, as you can see. Serve me as faithfully as you have served my cousin, and no harm need come to any of you." He brought them forward one by one, asked each man his name, then bid them kneel and swear him their allegiance. It all went swiftly. The soldiers of the garrison, only four had survived the attack, the old sergeant and three boys, laid their swords at his feet. No one balked. No one died. That night in the great hall, the victors feasted on roast meats and fresh-caught fish, washed down with rich red wines from the castle cellars. John Connington presided from the griffin seat, sharing the high table with homeless Harry Strickland, Black Ballack, Franklin Flowers, and the three young griffins they had taken captive. The children were of his blood, and he felt that he should know them. But when the bastard boy announced, "My father's gonna kill you," he decided that his knowledge was sufficient, ordered them back to the cells, and excused himself. Holden Halfmaester had been absent from the feast. Lord John found him in the maester's tower, bent over a pile of parchments, with maps spread out all around him. "Hoping to determine where the rest of the company might be," Connington asked him. "Would that I could, my lord." 10,000 men had sailed from Volunteers, with all their weapons, horses, elephants. Not quite half that number had turned up thus far on Westeros, at or near their intended landing site, a deserted stretch of coast on the edge of the Rainwood. Lands that John Connington knew well, as they had once been his. Only a few years ago, he would never have dared attempt a landing on Cape Wrath. The Stormlords were too fiercely loyal to House Baratheon and to King Robert. But with both Robert and his brother Renly slain, everything was changed. Stannis was too harsh and cold a man to inspire much in the way of loyalty, even if he had not been half a world away, and the Stormlands had little reason to love House Lannister. and John Connington was not without his own friends here. Some of the older lords will still remember me, and their sons will have heard the stories. And every man of them will know of Rhaegar and his young son, whose head was smashed against a cold stone wall. Fortunately, his own ship had been one of the first to reach their destination. Then it had only been a matter of establishing a campsite, assembling his men as they came ashore, and moving quickly, before the local lordlings had any inkling of their peril. And there the Golden Company had proved its mettle. The chaos that would inevitably have delayed such a march, with a hastily assembled host of household knights and local levies, had been nowhere in evidence. These were the heirs of bitter steel, and discipline was mother's milk to them. "By this time on the morrow, we ought to hold three castles," he said. The force that had taken Griffin's Roost represented a quarter of their available strength. Sir Tristan Rivers had set off simultaneously for the seat of House Morrigan at Crow's Nest, and Lasswell Peak for Rainhouse, the stronghold of the Wilds, each with a force of comparable size. The rest of their men had remained in camp to guard their landing site, and Prince, under the command of the company's volunteer paymaster, Goris Edorian. Their numbers would continue to swell, one hoped. More ships were straggling in every day. "We still have too few horses." "And no elephants," the half-maester reminded him. Not one of the great cogs carrying the elephants had turned up yet. They had last seen them at Lice, before the storm that had scattered half the fleet. "Horses can be found in Westeros. Elephants do not matter." The great beasts would be useful in a pitched battle, no doubt, but it would be some time before they had the strength to face their foes in the field. "Have those parchments told you anything of use?" "Oh, much and more, my lord." Holden gave him a thin smile. "The Lannisters make enemies easily, but seem to have a harder time keeping friends. Their alliance with the Tyrells is fraying, to judge from what I read here. Queen Cersei and Queen Margaery are fighting over the little king like two bitches with a chicken bone, and both have been accused of treason and debauchery. Mace Tyrell has abandoned his siege of Storm's End to march back to King's Landing and save his daughter, leaving only a token force behind to keep Stannis' men penned up inside the castle." Connington said, "Tell me more." "In the north, the Lannisters are relying on the Boltons, and in the Riverlands upon the Freys. Both houses long renowned for treachery and cruelty. Lord Stannis Baratheon remains in open rebellion, and the Ironborn of the Islands have raised up a king as well. No one ever seems to mention the Vale, which suggests to me that the Aerons have taken no part in any of this." "And Dawn?" The Vale was far away. Dawn was close. "Prince Doran's younger son has been betrothed to Marcella Baratheon, which would suggest that the Dornishmen have thrown in with House Lannister. But they have an army in the Boneway and another in the Prince's Pass, just waiting."
"Waiting?" he frowned. "For what?" "Without Daenerys and her dragons, Dawn was central to their hopes."
"Right, Sunspear. Dorian Martell must know that his sister's son is still alive, and has come home to claim his father's throne."
"As you say, my lord." The half-maester glanced at another parchment. "We could scarcely have timed our landing better. We have potential friends and allies at every hand."
"But no dragons," said John Connington. "So to win these allies to our cause, we must needs have something to offer them."
"Gold and land are the traditional incentives."
"Would that we had either. Promises of land and promises of gold may suffice for some, but Strickland and his men will expect first claim on the choicest fields and castles, those that were taken from their forebears when they fled into exile."
"No."
"My lord does have one prize to offer," Holden Halfmeister pointed out. "Prince Aegon's hand.
a marriage alliance to bring some great house to our banners.
A bride? For our bright prince? John Connington remembered Prince Rhaegar's wedding all too well. Ilya was never worthy of him. She was frail and sickly from the first, and childbirth only left her weaker. After the birth of Princess Rhaenys, her mother had been bedridden for half a year, and Prince Aegon's birth had almost been the death of her. She would bear no more children, the maesters told Prince Rhaegar afterward.
Daenerys Targaryen may yet come home one day, Cunnington told the half-maester. Aegon must be free to marry her.
My lord knows best, said Holden. In that case, we might consider offering potential friends a lesser prize.
What would you suggest?
You are unwed?
A great lord, still virile, with no heirs except these cousins we have just now dispossessed. The scion of an ancient house with a fine stout castle and wide rich lands that will no doubt be restored and perhaps expanded by a grateful king, once we have triumphed. You have a name as a warrior, and as King Aegon's hand, you will speak with his voice and rule this realm in all but name.
I would think that many an ambitious lord might be eager to wed his daughter to such a man, even perhaps the Prince of Dawn. John Connington's answer was a long, cold stare. There were times when the half-maester vexed him almost as much as that dwarf had.
I think not. Death is creeping up my arm. No man must ever know, nor any wife.
He got back to his feet. Prepare the letter to Prince Doran.
As my lord commands.
John Connington slept that night in the lord's chambers, in the bed that had once been his father's, beneath a dusty canopy of red and white velvet. He woke at dawn to the sound of falling rain and the timid knock of a serving man, anxious to learn how his new lord would break his fast.
Boiled eggs, fried bread and beans, and a jug of wine. The worst wine in the cellar.
The worst, my lord.
You heard me.
When the food and wine had been brought up, he barred the door, emptied the jug into a bowl, and soaked his hand in it. Vinegar soaks and vinegar baths were the treatment Lady L'Amour had prescribed for the dwarf, when she feared he might have grayscale. But asking for a jug of vinegar each morning would give the game away. Wine would need to serve, though he saw no sense in wasting a good vintage. The nails on all four fingers were black now, though not yet on his thumb. On the middle finger, the grey had crept up past the second knuckle.
I should act them off, he thought, but how would I explain two missing fingers?
He dare not let the grey scale become known. Queer as it seemed, men who would cheerfully face battle and risk death to rescue a companion would abandon that same companion in a heartbeat if he were known to have grayscale. I should have let the damned dwarf drown. Later that day, garbed and gloved once more, Connington made an inspection of the castle and sent word to homeless Harry Strickland and his captains to join him for a war council. Nine of them assembled in the solar. Connington and Strickland, Holden Halfmaester, Black Ballack, Sir Franklin Flowers, Malo Jane, Sir Brendelburne, Dick Cole, and Lyman Pease. The half-maester had good tidings. Words reached the camp for Mark Mandrake. The Volantines put him ashore on what turned out to be Estamont, with close to 500 men. He's taken Greenstone. Estamont was an island off Cape Wrath, never one of their objectives.
The damn Volantines are so eager to be rid of us, they are dumping us ashore on any bit of land they see, said Franklin Flowers. I'll wager you that we've got lads scattered all over half the bloody Stepstones, too.
With my elephants, Harry Strickland said in a mournful tone.
He missed his elephants, did homeless Harry.
"Mandrake had no archers with him," said Lyman Pease.
"Do we know if Greenstone got off any ravens before it fell?"
"I expect they did," said John Connington. "But what messages would they have carried? At best, some garbled account of raiders from the sea?" Even before they had sailed from Volunteers, he had instructed his captains to show no banners during these first attacks. Not Prince Aegon's three-headed dragon, nor his own griffins, nor the skulls and golden battle standards of the company. Let the Lannisters suspect Stannis Baratheon, pirates from the Stepstones, outlaws out of the woods, or whoever else they care to blame. If the reports that reached King's Landing were confused and contradictory, so much the better. The slower the Iron Throne was to react, the longer they would have to gather their strength and bring allies to the cause. "There should be ships on Estamont. It is an island. Holden, send words to Mandrake to leave a garrison behind and bring the rest of his men over to Cape Wrath, along with any noble captives."
"As you command, my lord. House Estamont has blood ties to both kings, as it happens. Good hostages."
"Good ransoms," said Homeless Harry, happily.
"It is time we sent for Prince Aegon as well," Lord John announced. "He will be safer here behind the walls of Griffin's Roost than back at camp."
"I'll send a rider," said Franklin Flowers. "But the lad won't much like the idea of staying safe, I'll tell you that. He wants to be in the thick of things."
"So did we all at his age," Lord John thought, remembering.
"Has the time come to raise his banner?" asked Pease.
"Not yet. Let King's Landing think this is no more than an exile lord coming home with some hired swords to reclaim his birthright. An old familiar story, that. I will even write King Tommen, stating as much, and asking for a pardon and the restoration of my lands and titles. That will give them something to chew over for a while. And whilst they dither, we will send out word secretly to likely friends in the Stormlands and the Reach and Dawn." That was the crucial step. Lesser lords might join their cause for fear of harm or hope of gain. But only the Prince of Dawn had the power to defy House Lannister and its allies.
"Above all else, we must have Dorin Martell."
"Small chance of that," said Strickland. "The Dornish man is scared of his own shadow. Not what you call daring."
"No more than you. Prince Dorin is a cautious man, that's true. He will never join us unless he is convinced that we will win. So to persuade him, we must show our strength. If Peak and Rivers are successful, we will control the better part of Cape Wrath," argued Strickland.
"Four castles in as many days, that's a splendid start. But we are still only at half strength. We need to wait for the rest of my men. We are missing horses as well, and the elephants. Wait, I say. Gather our power. Win some small lords to our cause. Let Lysanomar dispatch his spies to learn what we can learn of our foes."
Cunnington gave the plump Captain General a cool look. "This man is no Blackheart, no Bitter Steel, no Malice. He would wait until all seven hells were frozen, if he could, rather than risk another bout of blisters.
We did not cross half the world to wait. Our best chance is to strike hard and fast before King's Landing knows who we are. I mean to take Storm's End, a nigh impregnable stronghold, and Stannis Baratheon's last foothold in the south. Once taken, it will give us a secure fastness to which we may retreat at need, and winning it will prove our strength."
The captains of the Golden Company exchanged glances.
"If Storm's End is still held by men loyal to Stannis, we will be taking it from him, not the Lannisters," objected Brendelburn. "Why not make common cause with him against the Lannisters? Stannis is Robert's brother, of that same ilk that brought down House Targaryen, John Connington reminded him. Moreover, he is 1,000 leagues away, with whatever meagre strength he still commands. The whole realm lies between us. It would take 30 years just to reach him, and he has little and less to offer us. If Storm's End is so impregnable, how do you mean to take it? Asked Melo.
By guile.
Homeless Harry Strickland disagreed.
We should wait.
We shall, John Connington stood. 10 days, no longer. It will take that long to prepare. On the morning of the 11th day, we ride for Storm's End.
The prince arrived to join them 4 days later, riding at the head of a column of 100 horse, with 3 elephants lumbering in his rear. Lady L'Amour was with him, garbed once more in the white robes of a sceptre. Before them went Sir Raleigh Dockfield, a snow-white cloak streaming from his shoulders. A solid man, and true, Cunnington thought as he watched Dock dismount, but not worthy of the king's guard. He had tried his best to dissuade the prince from giving Dockfield that cloak, pointing out that the honour might best be held in reserve for warriors of greater renown whose fealty would add lustre to their cause, and the younger sons of great lords whose support they would need in the coming struggle. But the boy would not be moved.
"Duck will die for me if need be," he had said, "and that's all I require in my king's guard. The Kingslayer was a warrior of great renown, and the son of a great lord as well."
At least I convinced him to leave the other 6 slots open, else Duck might have 6 ducklings trailing after him, each more blindingly adequate than the last. "Escort his grace to my solar," he commanded, "at once." Prince Aegon Targaryen was not near as biddable as the boy young Griff had been, however. The better part of an hour had passed before he finally turned up in the solar, with Duck at his side.
"Lord Connington," he said, "I like your castle."
"Your father's lands are beautiful," he said. His silvery hair was blowing in the wind, and his eyes were a deep purple, darker than this boy's.
"As do I, Your Grace. Please be seated. Sir Raleigh, we'll have no further need of you for now."
"No, I want Duck to stay," the prince said. "We've been talking with Strickland and Flowers. They told us about this attack on Storm's End that you're planning."
John Connington did not let his fury show.
"And did Homeless Harry try to persuade you to delay it?"
"He did, actually," the prince said. "But I won't. Harry's an old maid, isn't he?" "You have the right of it, my lord. I want the attack to go ahead. With one change, I mean to lead it."
The Sacrifice. On the village green, the queen's men built their pyre.
Or should it be the village white?
The snow was knee-deep everywhere but where the men had shoveled it away, to hack holes into the frozen ground with axe and spade and pick. The wind was swirling from the west, driving still more snow across the frozen surface of the lakes.
"You do not want to watch this," Ali Mormont said.
"No, but I will."
Asha Greyjoy was the Kraken's daughter, not some pampered maiden who could not bear to look at ugliness. It had been a dark, cold, hungry day, like the day before and the day before that. They had spent most of it out on the ice, shivering beside a pair of holes they'd cut in the smaller of the frozen lakes, with fishing lines clutched in mittened clumsy hands. Not long ago they could count on hooking 1 or 2 fish apiece, and Wolfswood men, more practiced at ice fishing, were pulling up 4 or 5. Today all that Asha had come back with was a chill that went bone deep. Ali had fared no better. It had been 3 days since either of them had caught a fish. The she-bear tried again. "I do not need to watch this."
"It is not you the Queen's men want to burn." "Then go. You have my word, I will not run. Where would I go, to Winterfell?" Asher laughed. "Only 3 days' ride, they tell me." 6 Queen's men were wrestling 2 enormous pinewood poles into holes 6 other Queen's men had dug out. Asher did not have to ask their purpose. She knew. Stakes. Nightfall would be on them soon, and the Red Guard must be fed. "An offering of blood and fire," the Queen's men called it, "that the Lord of Light may turn his fiery eye upon us and melt these thrice-cursed snows. Even in this place of fear and darkness, the Lord of Light protects us," Sir Godfrey Fairing told the men who gathered to watch as the stakes were hammered down into the holes. "What has your southern god to do with snow?" demanded Artos Lint. His black beard was crusted with ice. "This is the wrath of the old gods come upon us. It is them we should appease." "Aye," said Big Bucket Wald. "Red Rollo means nothing here. You will only make the old gods angry. They are watching from their island." The crofters' village stood between 2 lakes, the larger dotted with small wooded islands that punched up through the ice like the frozen fists of some drowned giant. From one such island rose a weirwood, gnarled and ancient, its bole and branches white as the surrounding snows. 8 days ago, Asher had walked out with Ali Mormont to have a closer look at its slitted red eyes and bloody mouth. "It is only sap," she told herself. "The red sap that flows inside these weirwoods." But her eyes were unconvinced. Seeing was believing, and what they saw was frozen blood. "Your Northmen brought these snows upon us," insisted Corlys Penny. "You and your demon trees. Rillor will save us."
"Rillor will doom us," said Artus Flint.
"A pox on both ye gods," thought Asher Greyjoy. Sir Godfrey, the giant slayer, surveyed the stakes, shoving one to make certain it was firmly placed.
"Good, good. They will serve. Sir Clayton, bring forth the sacrifice."
Sir Clayton Suggs was Godfrey's strong right hand. Or should it be his withered arm? Asher did not like Sir Clayton. Where Fairing seemed fierce in his devotion to his red god, Suggs was simply cruel. She had seen him at the night fires, watching, his lips parted and his eyes avid. "It is not the god he loves, it is the flames," she concluded. When she asked Sir Justin if Suggs had always been that way, he grimaced.
"On Dragonstone he would gamble with the torturers and lend them a hand in the questioning of prisoners, especially if the prisoner were a young woman."
Asher was not surprised. Suggs would take a special delight in burning her, she did not doubt.
"Unless the storms let up."
They had been 3 days from Winterfell for 19 days.
100 leagues from Deepwood Mott to Winterfell, 300 miles as the raven flies.
But none of them were ravens, and the storm was unrelenting. Each morning Asher awoke, hoping she might see the sun, only to face another day of snow. The storm had buried every hut and hovel beneath a mound of dirty snow, and the drifts would soon be deep enough to engulf the long haul too. And there was no food, beyond their failing horses, fish taken from the lakes, fewer every day, and whatever meagre sustenance their foragers could find in these cold, dead woods. With the king's knights and lords claiming the lion's share of the horse meat, little and less remained for the common men. Small wonder, then, that they had started eating their own dead. Asher had been as horrified as the rest when the she-bear told her that 4 Peasbury men had been found butchering one of the late Lord Fells, carving chunks of flesh from his thighs and buttocks as one of his forearms turned upon a spit. But she could not pretend to be surprised. The 4 were not the first to taste human flesh,
during this grim march, she would wager. Only the first to be discovered. Peasbury's four would pay for their feast with their lives, by the king's decree, and by burning end the storm, the queen's men claimed. Asher Greyjoy put no faith in their red god, yet she prayed that they had the right of that. If not, there would be other pyres, and Sir Clayton Suggs might get his heart's desire. The four flesh-eaters were naked when Sir Clayton drove them out, their wrists lashed behind their backs with leathern cords. The youngest of them wept as he stumbled through the snow. Two others walked like men already dead, eyes fixed upon the ground. Asher was surprised to see how ordinary they appeared. "Not monsters," she realized, "only men." The oldest of the four had been their sergeant. He alone remained defiant, spitting venom at the queen's men as they prodded him along with their spears. "Fuck you all, and fuck your red god too," he said. "You hear me, Fairing? Giant slayer? Ha! I laughed when your fucking cousin died, Godfrey. We should have eaten him too. He smelled so good when they roasted him. Ha! I bet the boy was nice and tender. Juicy!" A blow from a spear butt drove the man to his knees, but did not silence him. When he rose, he spat out a mouthful of blood and broken teeth, and went right on. "The cock's the choicest part, all crisp up on the spit, a fat little sausage." Even as they wrapped the chains around him, he raved on, "Corliss Penny, come over here. What sort of name is Penny? Is that how much your mother charged? And you, Suggs, you bleeding bastard, you—" Sir Clayton never said a word. One quick slash opened the sergeant's throat, sending a wash of blood down his chest. The weeping man wept harder, his body shaking with each sob. He was so thin that Asher could count every rib.
"No, he begged, please, he was dead, and we was hungry, please."
"The sergeant was the clever one," Asher said to Ali Mormont. "He goaded Suggs into killing him." She wondered if the same trick might work twice, should her own turn come. The four victims were chained up back to back, two to a stake. There they hung, three live men and one dead one, as the Lord of Light's devout stacked split logs and broken branches under their feet, then doused the piles with lamp oil. They had to be swift about it. The snow was falling heavily, as ever, and the wood would soon be soaked through. "Where is the king?" asked Sir Corliss Penny. 4 days ago, one of the king's own squires had succumbed to cold and hunger, a boy named Byron Fairing, who had been kin to Sir Godfrey. Stannis Baratheon stood grim-faced by the funeral pyre as the lad's body was consigned to the flames. Afterward, the king had retreated to his watchtower. He had not emerged since, though from time to time his grace was glimpsed upon the tower roof, outlined against the beacon fire that burned there night and day. "Talking to the Red God," some said. "Calling out for Lady Melisandre," insisted others. Either way, it seemed to Asher Greyjoy the king was lost and crying out for help. "Canty, go find the king and tell him all is ready," Sir Godfrey said to the nearest man-at-arms.
"The king is here."
The voice was Richard Hawke's. Over his armour of plate and mail, Sir Richard wore his quilted doublet, blazoned with three death's head moths on a field of ash and bone. King Stannis walked beside him. Behind them, struggling to keep pace, Arnulf Karstark came hobbling, leaning on his blackthorn cane. Lord Arnulf had found them 8 days past. The Northmen had brought a son, three grandsons, 400 spears, 20 archers, 12 mounted lances, a maester, and a cage of ravens, but only enough provisions to sustain his own. Karstark was no lord, in truth, Asher had been given to understand, only a castellan of Garhold, for as long as the true lord remained a captive of the Lannisters. gaunt and bent and crooked, with a left shoulder half a foot higher than his right. He had a scrawny neck, squinty grey eyes, and yellow teeth. A few white hairs were all that separated him from baldness. His forked beard was equal parts white and grey, but always ragged. Asher thought there was something sour about his smiles. Yet if the talk was true, it was Karstark who would hold Winterfell, should they take it. Somewhere in the distant past, House Karstark had sprouted from House Stark, and Lord Arnulf had been the first of Eddard Stark's bannermen to declare for Stannis. So far as Asher knew, the guards of the Karstarks were the old guards of the North, guards they shared with the Wolves, the Norris, the Flints, and the other hill clans. She wondered if Lord Arnulf had come to view the burning at the king's behest, that he might witness the power of the Red Guard for himself. At the sight of Stannis, two of the men bound to the stakes began to plead for mercy. The king listened in silence, his jaw clenched. Then he said to Godfrey Faring, "You may begin." The giant slayer raised his arms. "Lord of Light, hear us!" "Lord of Light, defend us," the queen's men chanted, "for the night is dark and full of terrors." Sir Godfrey raised his head towards the darkening sky. "We thank you for the sun that warms us, and pray that you will return it to us, O Lord, that it might light our path to your enemies." Snowflakes melted on his face. "We thank you for the stars that watch over us by night, and pray that you will rip away this veil that hides them, so we might glory in their sight once more." "Lord of Light, protect us," the queen's men prayed, "and keep this savage dark at bay." Sir Corlys Penny stepped forward, clutching the torch with both hands. He swung it about his head in a circle, fanning the flames. One of the captives began to whimper. "Rilor," Sir Godfrey sang, "we give you now four evil men. With glad hearts and true, we give them to your cleansing fires, that the darkness in their souls might be burned away. Let their vile flesh be seared and blackened, that their spirits might rise free and pure to ascend into the light. Accept their blood, O Lord, and melt the icy chains that bind your servants. Hear their pain, and grant strength to our swords, that we might shed the blood of your enemies. Accept this sacrifice, and show us the way to Winterfell, that we might vanquish the unbelievers." "Lord of Light, accept this sacrifice," 100 voices echoed. Sir Corlys lit the first pyre with the torch, then thrust it into the wood at the base of the second. A few wisps of smoke began to rise. The captives began to cough. The first flames appeared, shy as maidens darting and dancing from log to leg. In moments both the stakes were engulfed in fire.
"He was dead,"
the weeping boy screamed as the flames licked up his legs.
"We found him dead. Please, we was hungry."
The fires reached his balls as the hair around his cock began to burn. His pleading dissolved into one long, wordless shriek. Asher Greyjoy could taste the bile in the back of her throat. On the Arran Islands, she had seen priests of her own people slit the throats of thralls and give their bodies to the sea to honour the drowned god. Brutal as that was, this was worse.
"Close your eyes," she told herself. "Close your ears. Turn away. You did not need to see this."
The queen's men were singing some paean of praise for Red R'hllor, but she could not hear the words above the shrieks. The heat of the flames beat against her face, but even so she shivered. The air grew thick with smoke and the stink of burnt flesh, and one of the bodies still twitched against the red-hot chains that bound him to the stake. After a time,
The screaming stopped. Wordless, King Stannis walked away, back to the solitude of his watchtower.
Back to his beacon fire, Asha knew. To search the flames for answers.
Arn of Karstak made to hobble after him, but Sir Richard Hawp took him by the arm and turned him toward the long hall. The watchers began to drift away, each to his own fire and whatever meager supper he might find. Clayton Suggs sidled up beside her.
"Did the Iron Cunt enjoy the show?"
His breath stank of ale and onions.
"He has pig eyes,"
Asher thought. That was fitting. His shield and surcoat showed a pig with wings. Suggs pressed his face so close to hers that she could count the blackheads on his nose and said,
"The crowd will be even bigger when it's you squirming on a stick."
He was not wrong. The wolves did not love her. She was ironborn and must answer for the crimes of her people, for Moat Cailin and Deepwood Mott and Torrin Square, for centuries of reaving along the stony shore, for all Theon did at Winterfell.
"Unhand me, sir."
Every time Sugg spoke to her, it left her yearning for her axes. Asher was as good a finger dancer as any man on the Isles, and had 10 fingers to prove it.
"If only I could dance with this one."
Some men had faces that cried out for a beard. Sir Clayton's face cried out for an axe between the eyes. But she was axeless here, so the best she could do was to try to wrench away. That just made Sir Clayton grasp her all the tighter, glove fingers digging into her arm like iron claws.
"My lady asked you to let her go,"
said Ali Mormont.
"You would do well to listen, sir. Lady Asher is not for burning."
"She will be," Suggs insisted. "We have harbored this demon worshipper amongst us too long."
He released his grip on Asher's arm all the same. One did not provoke the she-bear needlessly. That was a moment Justin Massey chose to appear.
"The king has other plans for his prize captive,"
he said with his easy smile. His cheeks were red from the cold.
"The king, or you?"
Sugg snorted his contempt.
"Scheme all you like, Massey. She'll still be for the fire, her and her king's blood. There's power in king's blood, the Red Woman used to say. Power to please our lord."
"Let the law be content with the four we just sent him."
"Four base-born churls, a beggar's offering. Scum like that will never stop the snow. She might."
The she-bear spoke.
"And if you burn her, and the snow still fall, what then? Who will you burn next? Me?"
Asher could hold her tongue no longer.
"Why not Sir Clayton? Perhaps R'hllor would light one of his own.
A faithful man who will sing his praises as the flames lick at his cock."
Sir Justin laughed. Suggs was less amused.
"Enjoy your giggle, Massey. If the snow keeps falling, we will see who's laughing then."
He glanced at the dead men on their stakes, smiled, and went off to join Sir Godfrey and the other Queen's men.
"My champion,"
Asher said to Justin Massey. He deserved that much, whatever his motives.
"Thank you for the rescue, sir."
"It will not win you friends amongst the Queen's men,"
said the she-bear.
"Have you lost your faith in Red R'hllor?"
"I have lost faith in more than that," Massey said, his breath a pale mist in the air.
"But I still believe in supper. Will you join me, my ladies?"
Ali Mormont shook her head.
"I have no appetite."
"Nor I.
But you had best choke down some horse meat all the same, or you may soon wish you had. We had 800 horses when we marched from Deepwood Mott. Last night the count was 64.
That did not shock her. Almost all of their big destriers had failed, including Massey's own. Most of their palfreys were gone as well. Even the garrons of the Northmen were faltering for want of fodder.
But what did they need horses for? Stannis was no longer marching anywhere. The sun and moon and stars had been gone so long that Asha was starting to wonder whether she had dreamed them.
I will eat.
Ali shook her head. Not me.
Let me look after Lady Asha, then, Sir Justin told her. You have my word. I shall not permit her to escape.
The she-bear gave her grudging assent, deaf to the japery in his tone. They parted there, Ali to her tent, she and Justin Massey to the long hall. It was not far, but the drifts were deep, the wind was gusty, and Asha's feet were blocks of ice. Her ankles stabbed at her with every step. Small and mean as it was, the long hall was the largest building in the village, so the lords and captains had taken it for themselves, while Stannis settled into the stone watchtower by the lakeshore. A pair of guardsmen flanked its door, leaning on tall spears. One lifted the greased door flap for Massey, and Sir Justin escorted Asher through to the blessed warmth within. Benches and trestle tables ran along either side of the hall, with room for 50 men, though twice that number had squeezed themselves inside. A fire trench had been dug down the middle of the earthen floor, with a row of smoke holes in the roof above. The wolves had taken to sitting on one side of the trench, the knights and southern lords upon the other. The southerners looked a sorry lot, Asher thought. Gaunt and hollow-cheeked, some pale and sick, others with red and wind-scoured faces. By contrast, the Northmen seemed hale and healthy, big ruddy men with beards as thick as bushes, clad in fur and iron. They might be cold and hungry too, but the marching had gone easier for them, with their garrons and their bare paws. Asher peeled off her fur mittens, wincing as she flexed her fingers. Pain shut up her legs as her half-frozen feet began to thaw in the warmth. The crofters had left behind a good supply of peat when they fled, so the air was hazy with smoke and the rich earthy smell of burning turf. She hung her cloak on a peg inside the door after shaking off the snow that clung to it. Sir Justin found them places on the bench and fetched supper for the both of them, ale and chunks of horse meat, charred black outside and red within. Asher took a sip of ale and fell upon the horseflesh. The portion was smaller than the last she tasted, but her belly still rumbled at the smell of it. "My thanks, sir," she said, as blood and grease ran down her chin. "Justin, I insist." Massey cut his own meat into chunks and stabbed one with his dagger. Down the table, Will Foxglove was telling the men around him that Stannis would resume his march on Winterfell 3 days hence. He'd had it from the lips of one of the grooms who tended the king's horses.
"His grace has seen victory in his fires," Foxglove said. "A victory that will be sung of for 1,000 years in Lord's Castle and Peasant's Hut alike."
Justin Massey looked up from his horse meat. "The cold count last night reached 80. He pulled a piece of gristle from his teeth and flicked it to the nearest dog. "If we march, we will die by the hundreds."
"We will die by the thousands if we stay here," said Sir Humphrey Clifton. "Press on, or die, I say."
"Press on and die," I answered. "And if we reach Winterfell, what then? How do we take it? Half our men are so weak, they can scarce put one foot before another. Will you set them to scaling walls, building siege towers?"
"We should remain here until the weather breaks," said Sir Ormond Wilde,
a cadaverous old knight whose nature gave the lie to his name. Asher had heard rumours that some of the men-at-arms were wagering on which of the great knights and lords would be the next to die. Sir Ormond had emerged as a clear favourite. "And how much coin was placed on me, I wonder," Asher thought. "Perhaps there is still time
to put down a wager.
"Here, at least, we have some shelter,"
Wilde was insisting.
"And there are fish in the lakes."
"Too few fish and too many fishermen,"
Lord Peasbury said gloomily. He had good reason for gloom. It was his men Sir Godfrey had just burned, and there were some in this very hall who had been heard to say that Peasbury himself surely knew what they were doing, and might even have shared in their feasts.
"He's not wrong,"
grumbled Ned Woods, one of the scouts from Deepwood. Noseless Ned, he was called. Frostbite had claimed the tip of his nose 2 winters past. Woods knew the Wolfwood as well as any man alive. Even the king's proudest lords had learned to listen when he spoke.
"I know them lakes. You've been on them like maggots on a corpse, hundreds of you. Cut so many holes in the ice, it's a bloody wonder more haven't fallen through. Out by the island, their spaces look like a cheese the rat's been at."
He shook his head.
"Lakes are done. You fish them out."
"All the more reason to march," insisted Humphrey Clifton. "If death is our fate, let us die with swords in hand."
It was the same argument as last night and the night before. "Press on and die, stay here and die, fall back and die."
"Feel free to perish as you wish, Humphrey," said Justin Massey. "Myself, I would sooner live to see another spring." "As some might call that craven,"
Lord Peasbury replied.
"Better a craven than a cannibal."
Peasbury's face twisted in sudden fury.
"You—"
"Death is part of war, Justin."
Sir Richard Hope stood inside the door, his dark hair damp with melting snow.
"Those who march with us will have a share in all the plunder we take from Bolton and his bastard, and a greater share of glory, undying. Those too weak to march must fend for themselves, but you have my word. We shall send food once we have taken Winterfell."
"You will not take Winterfell."
We will,"
came a cackle from the high table, where Arnulf Carstark sat with his son Arthur and 3 grandsons. Lord Arnulf shoved himself up, a vulture rising from its prey. One spotted hand clutched at his son's shoulder for support.
"We'll take it for the Ned, and for his daughter, aye, and for the young wolf, too. Him who was so cruelly slaughtered. Me and mine will show the way, if need be. I've said as much to his good grace, the king. March, I said, and before the moon can turn, we'll all be bathing in the blood of Freys and Boltons."
Men began to stamp their feet, to pound their fists against the tabletop. Almost all were Northmen, Asher noted. Across the fire trench, the southern lords sat silent on the benches. Justin Massey waited until the uproar had died away. Then he said,
"Your courage is admirable, Lord Carstark, but courage would not breach the walls of Winterfell."
"How do you mean to take the castle, pray? With snowballs?" One of Lord Arnulf's grandsons gave answer.
"We'll cut down trees for rams to break the gates."
"And die."
Another grandson made himself heard.
"We'll make ladders scale the walls."
"And die."
Up spoke Arthur Carstark, Lord Arnulf's younger son.
"We'll raise siege towers. And die, and die, and die."
Sir Justin rolled his eyes.
"Gods be good, are all you Carstarks mad?"
"Gods," said Richard Hope.
"You forget yourself, Justin. We have but one god here. Speak not of demons in this company. Only the Lord of Light can save us now. Wouldn't you agree?"
He put his hand upon the hilt of his sword, as if for emphasis, but his eyes never left the face of Justin Massey. Beneath that gaze, Sir Justin wilted.
"The Lord of Light, I. My faith runs as deep as your own, Richard. You know that. It is your courage I question, Justin, not your faith. You have preached